welcome to the Court ODR Podcast. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the Court ODR Podcast. My name is Colin Rule. I'm CEO of ODR.com. And today I have my friend JJ with me to talk a little bit about his pioneering work in online dispute resolution and some of his current research. So JJ, thanks so much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here, Colin. Thank you for inviting me.
So why don't you start out and just say a little bit about yourself? You're a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. How long have you been there? And a little background on your connection to ODR.
Great. Happy to do it. Yeah. So my name is JJ Prescott. I'm a law professor at the Michigan Law School. I also have an appointment in the economics department because I got here through both a JD and a PhD, and my research really started off focusing on empirical work, particularly in the criminal justice system. And so I've been here since 2006, wrote a lot of different papers on criminal justice and settlement and litigation, also more recently on non-compete in the last couple decades, basically. But ODR came about, my interest in ODR came about in a slightly different way. I actually was spending time with a student who was fantastic, really great student, but who wasn't interested in becoming a lawyer. And we started kicking around problems in the world. And I had been interested in access to justice, particularly in the criminal justice system space, for a long time. Mm-hmm. And we started talking about warrants to appear for failure to appear and warrants for failure to pay. And we focused on the fact that it's so interesting that so much of what that is about is the fear that people have about going to a courthouse when they don't know what to expect and no real way to solve the problem in any other way. Mm-hmm. So we imagined some way of allowing people to surrender safely to the court so that they could get on some sort of payment plan or reschedule a hearing without taking even what is oftentimes a very small risk of being jailed for having that warrant outstanding. So that was our initial idea. And that got us talking to courts and starting to think about the logic of how something like that would have to work, what would be important, what wouldn't be important, what would the barriers be. And that's where it all started.
Wow. Amazing. And, you know, I love when I teach at law schools, when I find someone who has decided over the course of their legal education, you know what, I don't know if I want to be a lawyer. I don't know if I want to take the bar exam, but, you know, they're smart and they've learned a lot about justice. And I zero in on those folks because I want to recruit them to the ODR field. So I love that it was a student who got you initially thinking about this. So talk a little bit about how that turned into Matterhorn and the work you did at Matterhorn. Yeah,
sure. So it started with me and Ben Gubernick thinking about how we were going to do this. Neither of us are technologists or developers. I mean, at least at that time, we weren't. And so we were basically two law guys, one of whom knows some about programming and statistical analysis and loves to work with data, but that wasn't really enough. So we spent some time at the University of Michigan in their Office of Technology Transfer, trying to identify someone who could sort of help us connect some of the dots, think about how we could get the right skills to maybe build something. We wound up connecting with MJ Cartwright, who we had an incredible meeting. She had worked in the healthcare space for a long time, also on remote tools to help people.
Oh yeah, and MJ's a force of nature, absolutely.
Yeah, so I still remember we were at Sava's in Ann Arbor talking about this, and it was really something, I mean, she'd really never heard about any of the things we were talking about, you know, warrants for people who were too poor, didn't know how to resolve them, and how there were millions of these things out there and they cause people to not call the police when they need help and all sorts of problems. And so with her help, we were able to connect with a software development shop locally and start to build out something that could be piloted. And then I went into work reaching out to nearby courts, talking with them about this warrant resolution idea. And pretty quickly they said, that sounds great. We see the problem, but you know what makes our courts really difficult for people and also for us are traffic disputes. We have a ton of them. They take a ton of time. There are people who come here and wait for 5 hours to have a short conversation to negotiate their ticket if their record is a good one, for example. And interestingly, right after that, I got a ticket. And in fact, for a long time in my early presentations, I had a deck of slides of my daughter in the back of the car because that's where she was. And the police officer said, "Hey, listen, you know, your record is clean. It's great. If you go downtown, go down to the courthouse, make an appointment, they'll surely bump you down to something that won't put points on your
points."
Said, right. And I said, "Well, if that's true, why don't we do that right here?" Said, "Well, that's not really something I can do." So that's what I did. I made an appointment. I went down, waited about 4 hours, and there were 100 other people doing exactly the same thing. I went and I had a conversation with the prosecutor. He opened up this paper file or two pieces of paper in it. And he said, "Mr. Prescott, I can offer you impeding traffic because it's the first time you've done something like this." And I said, "I'll take it." And he said, "Okay, we're done here." And I just, it kind of blew my mind that all these people, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of hours of waste for these little minor conversations. And that's when I knew, listen, I care about warrants. I care about especially people who are poor, who are scared of the system and can't use it. But even people who get traffic tickets and who can pay them, but don't want to just write the ticket. They want to either contest it or talk to somebody about it. I mean, they're really also pushed out of courts because of these, you know, I mean, if you have a $150 ticket and you get paid by the hour, basically costs you more to take a day off work to deal with the ticket than to just pay it. And in that case, you really don't have a right. You really don't have a right to challenge a ticket in that situation. I mean, you just don't. It's, you know, it's just easier for you to accept whatever the government's allegation is.
Right, right. Well, and in the literature, I think Mark Galanter was the one who first talked about lumping it, which is just giving up, you know, and that's probably the number one dispute resolution approach across the United States, which is I look at the cost benefit analysis of me pursuing redress. And I just say, well, and, you know, as you say, the opportunity cost for me to take time off and go down and sit in a courthouse and wait for that conversation is higher than the cost of the ticket. So I might as well just pay it.
And so, we see that in small claims court, too, Colin, where it's pretty normal to have 50, 60, 70% default rates. And some of that is because people don't know that they're being sued. But a lot of it is, well, let's say I have a good argument. And I got a 50-50 chance of winning. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to take me a lot of time to get down there. And, you know, so even if I win, I sort of lose.
Right.
And if I lose by default, you know, they still have to come and find me. And yeah, I mean, it's actually pretty close. It's a close call. Of course, deciding not to show up has long-term consequences that aren't great for people, but a lot of people don't have the luxury of kind of putting off, they don't have the luxury of dealing with things right now that, you know,
absolutely. Well, and I want to compliment you because I think Matterhorn ended up building what I think is actually the most successful court ODR program in the United States around these traffic cases in Michigan. And, you know, I think you had 30, 40 courts, you know, that signed up to use the platform over time. And it's been running for 10 years and the courts all love that program. So we're actually coming in and trying to help out some of those courts too with sort of a next generation of it. But, you know, it was your vision, JJ, and all the great work that you and MJ did going around and building these relationships, because a lot of these courts that, you know, trust me, I've done this. I've gone into courts and said, "Hey, you should use technology to do this more efficiently." And they kind of look at you like, "I don't know. We tried to do stuff like this in the past. It hasn't worked out." You know, but to actually build it, launch it, and then have it work successfully for, I mean, how many cases are we talking? Probably hundreds of thousands
hundreds,
of cases.
Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of this.
Yeah, point. It's amazing. And think about your personal experience of going down and witnessing that. So I think it's an amazing example of thought to action that you put together. So,
well, thank you. I mean, I'll take that praise, Colin, because I mean, well, why not? To be honest, I think a lot of the progress was a result of me being a law professor and me, you know, coming from the University of Michigan, because those two things together within the state gave me a certain amount of credibility. I mean, I do think that you have a lot of new technology companies that have solutions, and I think people are rightly skeptical about whether or not they're really good as they say they are. But when a technology solution backed by you know, somebody who is also a lawyer and who kind of understands what it is that judges do, I think that made a pretty big difference. And honestly, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this a million times too, a court responding, well, that seems so easy. We would obviously be doing it if it were that easy. So it right. must not be allowed. Or well, there must be some problem that you're not talking about. And so
it's very interesting as you say that, because now that I'm doing some work in Michigan, you know, and I'm backed up, my boss is Bridget McCormick, you know, who was also a law professor at Michigan and obviously went to the Supreme Court. But I think that there, you know, there's a great book that I love by a guy named Simon Sinek, and he talks about start with why. And he said, you know, when you're selling something, people don't buy from you because of what you're selling. They buy from you because of why you're selling it. Mm-hmm. And the big brands are, they all have a very strong why. And I think that, look, as a vendor who is selling to courts, I understand the skepticism, because there are a lot of companies that go out there and promise the moon and the stars. And then when you get into it, you're like, oh man, this is not what I thought it was going to be. But if you're buying from somebody and you know their values, and I think that's true with you as a law professor, I think that's true with Bridget, I like to think it's true with me, because, you know, like my younger kid's name is Alexander David Rule for the initials, you know, and he's 25. So, you know, like people know the why. They believe it's like, okay, I understand why you're doing this, and I don't understand all of the what, but we can figure that out together so long as I have the why squared away. And I think that you're right. I think a lot of people did trust you and Matterhorn and MJ because of the roots of where the project came from. And because also, you know, you were in Michigan. I think those were all really important things that got the court to say, I can trust these guys, and let's dive into the unknown a little bit with them.
And as you know, once you have a few courts, especially courts with leaders that are known to be leaders, once they dive in, and the world doesn't end, others are easier to persuade.
Absolutely.
Especially once they start talking up your solution, explaining why it's making their lives easier, how much time they're saving, and so on. And that was also the case with Matterhorn, is, you know, pretty much, you know, you always have problems getting things going in the beginning, but pretty much, you know, to a judge, to a user, people were always super happy, even the ones who were very skeptical. So
sure. Well, so let's talk about where you've gone since then. You shared with me a really great article that you did for the Alaska Law Review talking about court-connected ODR. But what are your research interests now? What are you focused on?
Yeah, so I write in other areas as well, but in the ODR space, I mean, I'm interested in AI. My training as an empirical economist makes me really interested in machine learning more generally. Mm-hmm. And I have for a long time been interested in the use of analytics in ODR.
Absolutely.
And also in moving on to adjudication, you know, sort of online adjudication that might even happen in a asynchronous text-based way. And so this article in Alaska came out of a symposium put on by the Alaska Law Review, interested in access to justice and the use of technology, my contribution related to the use of technology. And, you know, at the end of 2003, they had launched a new system that had a number of features that I really liked. I mean, it had limitations as well, of course, and I talk about those in the article, mm-hmm. but some of the nice features of it, I thought were ones that were worth talking about and sharing. And so, you know, some of those were, you know, you know, it was really easy to sign up, and you didn't have to have an existing case. So a lot of times there has to be an existing case filed in a court so that there's some record of the legal matter, and
right.
then you can maybe access. Well, that's not true in Alaska. When AKODR launched, they decided to make it really so that you could start a claim right from your phone. Well, actually not from your phone. That was one of the challenges, but right from your computer. And you could list somebody and invite them to a negotiation space. And honestly, it wasn't even restricted to an Alaska resident. Of course, if you wanted to turn it into an enforceable order later on, that I assume would require something more than just signing up online mm-hmm. from another state. But I was able to for example, ask one of my RAs to make a claim against me in small claims. And we were able to use the system to kind of negotiate this fake claim to see how it would work. And so it was so easy to get on and start using that I thought, okay, this is a great way for a state that, you know, is relatively small in terms of population to really potentially bring in testers, users to use this. And then on top of that, they had plans, and I hope still have plans in the future, to move on to online adjudication asynchronously. So, they had used it for negotiation, and then it also included mediation, where the courts would provide a mediator who would enter into an asynchronous mediation and help both sides. And the next step on this process was to move on to actually having a decision maker who would be making determinations as a result of, you know, of the exchanges going on. And, yeah, you know, they were working out some of the details when I last talked to them about this, like how would the back and forth go, what sort of procedural requirements would exist in this space, what kind of finality would a decision have. And those are all really hard and interesting questions, but Alaska was pushing, as far as I know, maybe you know of another place, pushing farther than anybody else I knew at the time had really been pushing.
No, you're 100% right. I think Alaska has been very, very innovative in thinking about all these tools and the ways to do it right. You know, one of the frustrations I had when I first started working with Tyler on Modria, my prior ODR platform, was, first of all, they said, well, we have to have the case e-filed and a response filed before we start ODR. And that frustrated me because obviously there's filing fees associated with that. And also it imposes a certain narrative on the dispute, you know, because going through the e-filing process sort of says, well, this is me versus you. And again, I'm on record as saying initially when I started working in ODR, I never wanted to sell ODR to the courts. I wanted to get bulletin boards outside of all the courts that said, don't go in there, you know, come to ODR.com and we'll take care of you. And I think I love the idea of anybody can come and start using the platform. I think that really lowers a lot of the barriers to entry in the use of these
platforms. You know, to take it a little further, I mean, they do require when you make a claim that you state the nature of your legal claim against the person. And in the paper, I ask, why do that? You know, if I have some sort of dispute with my neighbor or somebody in my neighborhood, I may not really even want to characterize it as a claim or a dispute or even put a label on it. Why not allow something that essentially lets people start a conversation? You don't really need a case type until it moves into the courts.
Oftentimes the types that the courts have aren't meaningful or helpful to the parties. Right. Like saying I have a small claims dispute, really the only thing that defines that is the monetary value of the case. I mean, there could be 1,000 different types. It could be a barking dog or an IP case or, you know, a property case or a consumer case. But just to say, well, this is a small claims case. Well, is that helping the parties understand the path to resolution? So
totally. And there's one other feature that I thought reduced the potential utility of AKODR, which was the fact that only somebody who was in the role of a plaintiff could initiate the ODR. So if you had a claim and you'd made a claim, you could start it. Or if it was I think the definition that they use is the person who is claiming they are owed something or that they deserve something, they have to start ODR, which I thought, you know, listen, some of the people are going to benefit most from ODR and are probably going to put the time into it are going to be defendants in debt cases, for example, who live too far away. They're the ones who might say, okay, you filed a case against me or you made a claim against me. I would like to use this system because it will make my life a lot easier. But in Alaska and its initial implementation, that was not possible. So you could only use ODR aggressively as a plaintiff. You couldn't use it as a way to reduce the costs for somebody who was defending.
You know, another frustration I had with the way that Tyler framed ODR, and this was, you know, this was early, this was 10 years ago, was that it was always the facilitative piece. It was, well, let's focus on the negotiation. Let's focus on the mediation, you know. And I think, again, I think you cite in your article the National Center for State Courts definition of ODR, which is a, you know, an online collaborative workspace where the parties can convene to resolve their dispute or case, which I think is a pretty good description of part of ODR. But obviously, and I want to go back to what you said before, there is an evaluative piece. I mean, I'm building a lot of online arbitration systems where it goes all the way through to an award being made by an arbitrator or a panel of arbitrators. And it's interesting to me that court ODR has really steered clear of that. And I think the reason why Tyler felt that way was because they said, well, that's what the courts do. You know, the judges are in the business of evaluating cases and rendering decisions. Let's build ODR to just focus on this facilitative phase in advance of the hearing. And if the parties can work it out, great, you can cancel the hearing. But in the United States, I don't think there's been any examples of court ODR that goes all the way through the evaluative process and rendering a decision. Now, other courts around the world have embraced that. Even in British Columbia, which isn't that far away from Alaska, the Civil Resolution Tribunal does have an all online process where you never have to show up in person, and you can go all the way through the decision. And if you get a decision from the Civil Resolution Tribunal, it's just as enforceable as if you went through the face-to-face process. And it's worked great. I mean, they have tons and tons of data that they pulled out of the CRT showing that parties really appreciate that all online option. So I really appreciate you calling this out, because I do think there's huge potential for evaluative ODR in the courts. And I know Alaska is far ahead on thinking about this, but I think it's coming for other states as well.
You know, and it doesn't have to be a judge, right? To the extent judges are worried about it, I mean, you're exactly right that you can have other parties serving in this role, arbitrators. I mean, if you think about the types of evaluative in-person procedural tools that are out there, case evaluation in Michigan, for example, which, you have three experts sit on a abbreviated presentation of the facts.
Sure.
They announce a value on the case, and then the parties use that and sort of creates an offer of judgment type of situation. It doesn't resolve the case, but it certainly changes the case in an important way. And of course, if you just use ADR and have somebody and everybody agrees to go with what the arbitrator says, there's no reason I don't think that maybe the next step for courts ought to be to do that, to allow the parties to say, even if judges don't want to play that role, to have somebody, or to have a stock of arbitrators who can do this sort of work.
Absolutely. And, I mean, we're now part of the American Arbitration Association, so I'm learning a lot about good arbitration. You know, how do you design these processes so they're transparent and they're just? And I think there is a lot that can be learned from some of the arbitration mechanisms and vice versa. I mean, I think courts can teach things to arbitration institutions, and arbitration institutions have lessons as well.
One of the things that's interesting, because there, Matterhorn in Arizona for a while was deployed in a pilot in some criminal misdemeanor spaces. And there, there's a lot, I think, more questions once you have an evaluative part of this about public access to the proceeding.
Sure.
If you decide to opt out of the system and you're using arbitration, fine. That's basically akin to settlement. You're resolving it privately. But if you're going to have an online hearing, essentially, but it's going to happen in asynchronous text, how exactly do we make sure that the public is able to access that? What would that look like? I mean, to me, these are really interesting questions. And of course, I can imagine a few different ways that might be, but I think an important research question is, how will people react to them? So some of my interests are, of course, both in improving the efficiency of courts, how do we do that, but also in how are people's views about courts and judges' decision-making and lawyers' behavior, how are they going to change in ways that we should anticipate so that we can either, avoid pitfalls or improve their behavior?
Immediately arguments pop to mind as to how these online asynchronous processes can actually improve transparency in terms of people knowing what's going on in these cases. When I first came to Tyler, I'm a non-lawyer mediator, right? My background's in public policy and technology. So I said, look, I don't do anything on the criminal side. Like, this is really about civil cases and just, working out issues. But I had an opportunity to meet a lot of judges on the criminal side who were working with Tyler. And they said, you realize most criminal cases are resolved through negotiation.
Yep.
And I said, what do you mean? And I said, well, it's the public defender and it's, the district attorney, and they're making offers back and forth, you know, and trying to figure out what an appropriate resolution is. So again, it's not the same thing as, you know, putting the victim and the offender together in an environment to negotiate a resolution. But clearly, these tools are relevant on that side of the equation as well. And I do think that this, you know, the kind of historic bias towards face-to-face is going, the culture is changing around the legitimacy of these online processes. And, you know, we're starting to realize that, you know, requiring face-to-face participation is its own form of privilege, especially in a place like Alaska, you know, where you may have, you know, one side is right across the street from the courthouse and the other one's 3 hours away. So by insisting that it all happened face-to-face, well, you are creating a power imbalance. Between
3 hours and a plane flight. Since and a plane flight. Communities right. There are not even connected by roads to
exactly. So this is such a fascinating conversation, JJ, and I want to continue it with you. But let me take it back to something you said, and this is squarely in your expertise area, which is about data, which is about research. And one of the things that we didn't have when we first started doing the court ODR stuff back in 2012, 2013. Was we didn't have any data about it. So a lot of this was sort of promise. Hey, maybe if we do this, we'll have these benefits. But I think one of the things that was great about Pew and the money they put into court ODR was they funded researchers who don't have a dog in the fight to take longitudinal looks at some of these court ODR programs and then see, you know, what worked the way that we expected it to work and what didn't work so well. And I think your quantitative background is really valuable. I know you're constantly asking yourself, okay, what data do we need here to sort of know what's really going on? But, as we move forward sort of on the next generation of court ODR, you know, what data would you like to get your hands on to really make sure that we're headed in the right direction?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I when I look at courts, the first thing that I find really frustrating is just how siloed they are in terms of their data resources. There's so much that is essentially replicated in courts that might be easily gained from other government agencies, right? So, you know, you have a whole hearing on, for example, ability to pay, but that question has already been answered by other departments within the government, and yet you don't have it. So for me, I think both in terms of thinking about outcomes and also in terms of thinking about efficiency, sources of data to courts outside of what happens in the court would be really useful. But in terms of thinking about in terms of rigorous research, one of the biggest challenges is making sure that people who use these tools, the kinds of information we're collecting from them and how we're collecting it from them is the same as the kind of data we're collecting from people who don't use the courts at all or who use the courts in more traditional ways. And that's mm-hmm. just a real challenge. I've tried to overcome it in a few different ways. So we give a survey to people who've used ODR and ask them some questions, but now we have to survey people who have used in-person proceedings. And how exactly do we do that? If we send a survey to somebody 3 days after their ODR outcome, so they have a little bit of time to think about it and they fill it out, how would I get the equivalent from somebody who is walking out of a courthouse? Do I ask them to give me their email address so I can send them a survey in 3 days? And really, I don't have a great solution to any of that other than encouraging courts to build the data infrastructure and connections to their users so that subsequent contact with them is a little bit easier. I mean, and this is, of course, a great source of problems for courts because, you know, people, especially people who have misdemeanors or who have outstanding warrants for failure to appear or failure to pay, you know, they move around a lot. And, you know, if you have a traditional mailing address for them, that oftentimes becomes stale very quickly, whereas a phone number won't become stale. And yet a lot of courts don't really collect phone numbers. So I don't know if that's a great answer. I mean, I don't have a great solution, but I'm always worried about control and treatment groups and trying to make sure that I can really compare apples to apples instead of just the people that I can connect to in those groups who wind up being, you know, differently selected depending on how you try to reach them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've wrestled with this over the, you know, 25 some odd years that I've been in ODR. I can get feedback from my participants at the end of the process. And say, yeah, what did you think about the process? But one of the challenges I've had is trying to separate outcome from perceived procedural justice, you know, because if you win, you like it. If you lose, you didn't like it, you know. And I think that there are, I think about Jared Curran at MIT. He's got this thing called the subjective value indicator, which is a series of questions that he's tested that gets to more of the perceived procedural legitimacy of the resolution as opposed to the outcome. But one of the things, and so I have a lot of data that I gather, and I know Matterhorn did this too, at the end of the process, but what confounds me is the longitudinal data, right? Because I have courts say to me, well, how do I know these outcomes are durable? Like if I do a face-to-face process, you know, maybe I don't see them for 10 years, but if they do an online process and it's really easy, well, maybe they're back in a year and then they want to renegotiate their terms. And I can't do that. Right. As a provider, I don't have the ability to follow up with parties a year or two or three down the road. And so much like you say, the access question of people who are in these cases, they move around, you know, it's hard to follow up with them. That longitudinal data, I think, is really important. And the only way that we're going to get rapid adoption of these techniques is if we can prove with data that not only that they're matching the quality of face-to-face outcomes, but even exceeding in a sense in terms of, you know, key variables like access and procedural satisfaction.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine trying to essentially match people who randomly, let's say we have a situation where we think there's some exogenous variation that allows some people to use ODR and some people just can't, maybe by time of adoption or something else. And then you look at court data down the road, maybe at the state level, so you feel like you're seeing other sorts of things. If you're worried about people coming back, you know, you know those are easier to observe, and people appearing either because they have subsequent misdemeanors, you know, something we might call recidivism, or just they are having new touches with the courts later on. It would be interesting and I think feasible to try to do that. How people feel a year later, that seems to me, what I thought early on, I don't know if you felt this way. When Matterhorn first started, people would search for their case. They'd resolve their case. They put in their information. Then the case would disappear. And there was nothing, you know, it was the court's data. And there was no long-term account that somebody would have, like a justice account with the court. But from the beginning, I thought, well, this seems silly. Like if people, the court has long-term relationships, and it really does because it holds records of people. It oftentimes knows about their obligations. It's oftentimes looking for them. But having an ongoing account with people that would allow, and maybe what it winds up being driven by is something at the state level, you know, something like your the same way you'd pay your state income taxes or some other relationship that would allow courts to be able to stay connected with their users over time. And that would facilitate, I would like to think, surveying people down the road. And I think you're right that, you know, going into a court, it can be both incredibly frustrating, but it's also more memorable. Mm-hmm. And so it might turn out that people who use these online tools, they don't even remember that they went to court. And I can see that being a good thing, but I can also see it being a bad thing when we want people to kind of understand that these resources are out there and remember how to use them well.
Yeah, I mean, part of the goal of a good resolution process is enabling the parties to put it in their rearview mirror and just not think about it anymore. Okay, we got a resolution. It's fair. I move on. I do my life. But, you know, this is one of the things we've seen on the family side when we built the Rectivisor. You know, parties would come in, go through the divorce and separation process, and they'd come up with an agreement. And then oftentimes mediators and courts would say, okay, we got the agreement. Thanks. Bye. But then later they would need to modify their understanding around child support. You know, obviously the cost of a 5-year-old are different than the cost of a 15-year-old. But, and then they would come back and they'd kind of have to start again. And we were saying, why? How does that make any sense? You know, like once we have the agreement, we should put it into an online platform. And if they need to make an adjustment, they should be able to log in and access it again. And then say, well, hey, can we adjust it this way? And the other side, says that's fine. And then you update it. And if you look at platforms like Our Family Wizard and some of these co-parenting management platforms, that's kind of what they're doing, right? They're filling in for the courts because it's about the ongoing adherence and evolution of the agreement, as opposed to, okay, we got an agreement, both sides signed it, we're done. Good luck to you. You know, call us if you have a problem.
And the agreement is an active agreement being essentially supervised by the court. So the idea that there's like an ongoing relationship with the court makes sense. And sure, it would be nice if we could make it so it's not something you had to think about every single day, But you also want to be able to access it easily and be able to kind of keep records and figure out what had happened in the past easily as well. And I think about using the bank software. You know, I can go on when I need to use a tool that my bank offers, and I can find my history. I can find out when I did things. I can, you know, it really helps
absolutely
me to like understand.
Amazon will tell you what you happened. Bought 10 years ago. Yeah, sure. Right. It makes sense. And the retention and access to those records is really easy again with technology, whereas it might be a lot harder for a court, you know, to have somebody come in and say, hey, I want to pull my file. Oh, wait, this is 10 years ago. You know, where did we put that? So look, JJ, as I say, I could talk to you all day about this stuff, and I hope we can do a part two, because, you know, as we make progress, I definitely want to benefit from your wisdom and eager to partner with you on the academic side too, because you're doing such path-breaking work. But I really do appreciate all your contributions to the ODR field. And thank you for spending the time today. And I look forward to continuing the discussion with you.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Colin. Thank you.
The Court ODR Podcast is brought to you by ODR.com. To learn more about ODR.com products and services, please visit us at ODR.com.